The following podcast is sponsored by Financial Sense Wealth Management. To learn more about our investment services, go to financialsense.com or give us a call at 888-486-3939.
Well, Elon Musk is hitting the pause button on his $44 billion Twitter takeover.
That's right. The billionaire and Tesla CEO tweeted this morning he wants more information behind Twitter's claim that less than 5% of its users are fake or spam accounts.
It's been a brutal week for crypto investors. The value of Bitcoin and other cryptocurrencies has plunged. The sell-off began after the collapse of what was supposed to be one of the safest crypto assets, the so-called stablecoin, whose value was pegged to the US dollar.
Feels like for years we've been told crypto's better because the incentives are better. But what's happening with TerraUSD? How is it not a black eye for the entire industry?
It's one of the worst scandals in the history of the crypto industry. It's a gigantic black eye. We're talking $55 billion of paper wealth wiped out.
Since February, we've been looking for sub 4,000 in the S&P. We got to 3860 a couple days ago. But today, we had more than 90% of NYSE volume as an advancing stock. So we have a huge surge in demand. So we think it's reasonable to expect to move back up to 4,200, which, by the way, was a huge support violation on the way down. We think it probably is going to act as resistance on the way up.
It's really incredible. Look at this border, the green Finland there on the map. 800 more miles of NATO butting up to Russia. How big of a game changer is that?
Very helpful for the alliance. Gives us the ability to base forces up there to conduct military operations. Also very important in access to the Arctic, which I think is going to be another zone of competition between NATO and Russia.
Prices at the pump hit a new record overnight, just in time for the peak summer driving season. According to AAA, the national average cost of gas is up to $4.37 per gallon.
With the exception of crude oil, the price of pretty much every liquid molecule out there hit new record highs today. So I know we had a wild consumer price index earlier this month. We're going to have another wild one when the May numbers come out in early June.
This is the Financial Sense News Hour. Now, here's the Financial Sense News Team.
Inflation continues to rise, with producer prices up 11% last month, making it five consecutive months of double-digit gains as the administration's policies continue to fuel inflation. The administration is now floating ideas of price controls. Well, those inflation worries and Fed rate hikes weighed on the markets with another week of losses for the major indexes. Hi, everyone. I'm Jim Poplavin. Welcome to the Financial Sense News Hour. Ralph Ancampora joins me at the top of the hour. Ralph sees more pain ahead for the stock market, but great buying opportunities when this thing plays itself out. Later on in the program, Gail Verberg joins me in a special interview as we explore why we are facing much higher oil prices in the years ahead as it becomes more difficult to increase oil production to meet demand. But first, let's find out the stories moving markets this week with Ryan Poplava.
On the cusp of entering the official criteria for a bear market, the bulls were able to rally the S&P 500 as it came just shy of being down 20% from the highs this year on Thursday. There wasn't a specific event on Friday to help close stocks off their lows, but that psychological level of a bear market, as well as the price level of 4,000, might have assisted in the rally. This week, the Nasdaq Composite lost 2.8%, the Russell 2000 lost 2.6%, the S&P 500 lost 2.4%, and the Dow Jones Industrial Average lost 2.1%. The worst performing sectors were information technology down 3.5%, consumer discretionary down 3.4%, financials down 3.6, real estate down 3.9, with consumer staples as the only sector able to rise up 0.3%. Stocks aren't the only area that has been under pressure. Cryptocurrencies played a big part in destabilizing risk assets. Bitcoin was down 12.5% this week, and CNBC reported on Thursday that $200 billion had been erased from the entire crypto market in a day. Confidence has been shaken by the asset class as a meltdown in TerraUSD, known as a stablecoin, broke its peg to the US dollar, leading to a race for the exit. The stablecoin broke a dollar peg on Monday and fell as low as 31 cents on Wednesday and was trading at 13 cents last I checked on Friday. Secretary of the Treasury Janet Yellen said She didn't think the losses could destabilize the financial markets, but it does call for regulation, in her opinion. Other growth concerns continue to weigh on risk assets. A list of those concerns were news this week Russia threatened retaliation if Finland joins NATO, news that Shanghai is again tightening COVID-19 restrictions with their lockdowns affecting supply chain issues, the IEA lowered its oil demand forecast, and Saudi Arabia cut oil prices for Asian buyers. And despite a drop in the consumer price index in April down to 8.3%, year-over-year growth from 8.5% in March, the underlying sentiment here is that the Fed will continue to tighten aggressively and core inflation will remain stubborn. We heard from many Fed officials who continue to reiterate that 50 basis points is the amount that they're looking to raise next month. And while the S&P 500 has been trading under a 17 multiple, there are concerns that future weakness has not been priced into earnings guidance, and these forward earnings multiples have still lower to go. These growth concerns have translated into some treasury bond and dollar buying activity this week. The 10-year treasury yield hit 3.2% overnight early in the week and hit a low of 2.81 on Thursday and then settled at 2.94 at the end of the week. The dollar rose just shy of 1% to 104.57. On the plus side of the ledger this week, David Tepper, the founder and president of Appaloosa Management, said early in the week he had closed out his short on the NASDAQ and was buying the S&P 500. David also said that he didn't think the NASDAQ would get below 12,000. David is known for making savvy investment decisions, and the call had moved the markets on Tuesday. This news, in addition to multiple technicians who feel the conditions are ripe for a rally, helped place a bid for stocks despite the weakness. However, the optics for a long-term bottom are a little bit more blurry. And that's it for this week's wrap-up report. Up next, Ralph Acampora to weigh in on this week's technical setups.
People are seriously wrong on a lot of things. I mean, the front page of this week's Economist says the Fed that failed. It just shows the lack of understanding of how the world economy even functions. I mean, their first line, central banks are supposed to inspire confidence in the economy by keeping inflation low and stable. This is such propaganda, it's amazing. The central bank has no power over the fiscal spending. Zero. All right. This is the collapse of Keynesian economics. You had inflation, so the Fed will be criticized like this. Oh, it has to raise interest rates to stop the inflation. But if this inflation is being caused by shortages, raising the interest rates will do nothing. So they don't even understand what we're dealing with here. This is not a speculative boom where you raise interest rates. Okay, fine. So it costs me more to make, to borrow, to speculate with. This is not what we're dealing with. We're dealing with outright shortages. And the more you raise the interest rates, the higher the cost of production, the fewer people will be able to borrow, and you get even a tighter supply.
To listen to this full interview, in addition to gaining access to all of our premium content airing during the week, go to financialsense.com and hit the subscribe button.
At Financial Sense Wealth Management, we are committed to helping you build, maintain, and preserve your wealth. Contact us today to find out about our comprehensive financial planning and asset management services. Whether you're planning for retirement, taxes, putting together an estate plan, or need assistance in managing a 401k, Financial Sense Wealth Management is here to help. Give us a call to speak with one of our certified financial planners or wealth advisors at 888-486-3939 or go to financialsense.com and hit where it says Contact Us. Advisory services offered through Financial Sense Advisors, Inc., a registered investment advisor. Securities offered through Financial Sense Securities, Inc., member FINRA SIPC. Both companies doing business as Financial Sense Wealth Management.
Joining us on the program is Ralph Acampora. And Ralph, let's take it from the top. Let's begin with Papa Dow, as you call it. And what are you seeing in the Dow and the transports? And what is that telling you?
Well, Jim, thanks for having me on again. Weeks ago, in my commentary to folks, as I issued a red line, my red line was the March low of this year. That was when the horrible war in Ukraine started. That low, to me, had to hold. And in the subsequent few weeks, it was the NASDAQ that broke it first, and then followed by the S&P. And just the other day, the Dow Jones Industrial Average closed below that low. So, and I, again, I'm talking strictly technically. What that unleashed was a downside from a period of almost a year of churning or consolidation above that level, that March level. And for me, that is significant, because almost 12 months of churning, if you will, in many cases, new highs, but they didn't last very long in the Dow and the S&P and even NASDAQ. But the breakdown below the red line suggests that we have another 10 to 15% before we hit the final bottom. So I hate to be negative, but I think it's best to just stay on the sidelines. I don't think it's time to step up at the plate just yet. Now, having said all of that, once this is over, and maybe you and I'll have another conference call when I feel that we've made a bottom, I think it's going to make an excellent buying opportunity. But between now and then, I think I'd be on the sidelines.
You know, one of the things that have held up well, and we're now starting to see a breakdown, and that are some of the strong tech stocks, your Apple, your Amazon, and your Microsoft. So when you see them breaking down, Ralph, I wonder if you might address how, you know, when you go through these kind of bear markets, first it's the troops are the larger stocks that go, and the generals are the last to decline. Talk about that for a minute.
That's good. That's very well said. It's the big names are the last to get hit. And that's because people, investors are on the sidelines, are just getting exasperated, losing money in other areas, and they start to liquidate across the board. And once they get to the generals, that's part of the final phase, if you will. So breaking that red line and now having the generals succumb to some of that downside pressure is all part of the, if you will, the last stages of a bear market.
And when you see this bear market, typical bear markets, they define a bear market traditionally with a 20% downside. If you look at the NASDAQ, we've gone beyond that. How do you see this market playing out? Is this a major downturn in your opinion, like, for example, what we saw with the bursting of the tech bubble in 2000 or the financial crisis in 2007?
Well, I even go back farther than that. I lived through the horrific Arab oil crisis in the 70s, 19, I didn't say 1870s, Jim, but 1970s. and again, as a technician, remember I said we have a year of churning, a year of distribution, a top formation, if you will, in many of the leading stocks. Well, in those periods of time, we had major distribution, which led to more than 20%. They led to 30%, 35%, in one case, a 45% decline. I'm not predicting a 45% decline, but in the case of NASDAQ, you know, a 30%, 35% decline, I think is in the offing. And with the generals starting to follow through, that's precipitating even more downside. So the, yes, the classic definition of a bear market is 20%, but this is going to be more than that, unfortunately.
So when you see these kind of downturns, Ralph, I remember once you told me about your wife, who was a broker on Wall Street, and she put her clients in dividend-paying stocks, and she held on to them. And the thing that struck me about the markets over the last couple of years, the yields on dividend-paying stocks were so much higher than what you could get in bonds. And Ralph, that's something I hadn't seen, so you'd probably have to go back to the 70s to see something like that.
Yeah, that's it's a beautiful story about Rosemary, and I still get, you know, she's retired, of course, but I still get the phone calls from her clients saying, thank you, Rosemary, for having them locked up into long-term investments like that. And in fact, that's what we have at home, too. And although, you know, I like to take more aggressive positions. And on those aggressive positions, we've liquidated a couple of weeks ago. So, yeah, it's that's the, for the long-term investors, high dividend, that's the name of the game over a period of time. Absolutely. And even the high dividend stocks today, relatively holding up relatively well. Of course, everything's coming down, but they've held up particularly better than most.
Yeah, because when you take a look at some of the dividends you get in the drug stocks, you take a look at consumer staples, your Coca-Colas and your Procter & Gambles, not only are they offering good dividend yields that are going up, but they haven't seen some of the carnage that we're seeing, for example, in a lot of these tech stocks. And Ralph, I wonder if you might address this, that people don't realize that your index is like the Dow are price-weighted. The S&P is market cap weighted. So when you have these strong generals, the Microsofts, the Amazons and Apple stock, they tend to hold up the index and disguise really underneath what's going on with the troops.
Yeah, when you say troops, we in the technical community call that the advanced decline line. In other words, how many stocks go up versus how many go down every day. That we call it the breadth of the market. And the breadth of the market has been deteriorating for many months now, which is usually the early signs of a problem, because it's, as you said before, it's the troops that are getting hurt, and then the generals are the last usually. And that has been working, you know, flawlessly, unfortunately, for the past several months. The breadth of the market has been very, very weak. The broad list of stocks, well below their respective red lines, those March lows.
Well, let's talk about something that has spooked the markets, and that's the Fed is raising interest rates. It's hard to believe 2 years ago, 10-year yields on the Treasury, they got down below 0.4%. Here we are. They got up to almost 3%. What's your take on interest rates here?
I'm sorry I can't show you a long-term picture of rates. 60, 70 years of rates. It's a 30-year cycle, 30 years up, 30 years down. And we've had rates, you probably remember this, in the early 80s, where rates were, you know, just so high. I mean, I think the prime rate was like 21%, 22%. And we've gone down to the lows that you're talking about. 30-year cycle is over. The next 30 years, I won't be around to see it, but the cycle is back up. So when I see 3%, people crying, oh, my heavens, it's 3%. And I just shake my head. I I remember buying an apartment in New York City in 1994. I paid 10.5% mortgage, and I kissed the bank at it, and it charged me 12%. So I tell people, if you're buying a house, don't worry about the 5% mortgage now. In your lifetime, it's going to be a lot higher. So to answer your question, long-term rates in general are headed higher. That cycle is back up. It'll pull back and it'll jerk around for a while, of course. I mean, it's never a straight line up, but over the next 20-plus years, you're going to see rates gradually working their way higher.
Yeah, I can remember when I first got in the business, Ralph, in the early 80s. I mean, all I did the first 10 years in the 80s, I did bonds. I mean, why would you want to be in stocks when you were getting 14% on Ginnie Mae's or 15% on a treasury?
Exactly. Yeah.
So one thing that we've seen associated with recessions, they've been preceded by inflation, a spike in oil prices, and a rise in interest rates coming from the Fed. What's your take on oil here, which is hovering over $100 a barrel?
Yeah, unfortunately, I see it going higher.
I do, too.
Yeah, and, you know, you can point your finger at any, you know, you can say the Ukrainian war or whatever. I mean, the momentum is there. Yes, it pulls back periodically for a couple of days. But again, technically, the major trend is higher. And unfortunately, I see at least another 10-15% easy on the upside.
Now, one of the things we have talked about, and this goes back to your Wise philosophy on holding high-quality dividend stocks for the long term, because if you cash out of a stock, you have a bear market. It's called taxes, and the tax rates could be 23.8, depending on your income, or in my own state of California, you can add state taxes of another 13 to the 23, and all of a sudden, you have a 37% loss.
Yeah, well, again, this is, you know, when talking about long-term investing, you got to live with the dips. But this is more than a dip, though, Jim. This is going to go in the books. as one of the worst ones, unfortunately.
As you look at charts, what is something that you find from a technical point of view the most useful thing that you follow? Because we have, Ralph, we have different technicians on the program, and everybody has like a particular tool or methodology that they use, because you could get two technicians looking at a chart and they might come away with different interpretations.
I'm glad you asked that question. You're talking to an old-time technician, okay? I'm a classic guy. You own price, okay? You don't own the RSI, the MACD, or the Bollinger Bands, and they're all wonderful tools, but you don't own them. So the first thing I look at is price. And I watch all these talking heads on television. They're drawing lines all over the place and they're Fibonacci, Liberace numbers. And, you know, I wonder what if they know what they're talking about. Can they draw a straight line? That's the second thing. I look at price. What trend are we in? Short, intermediate, long-term trend, up, neutral, down. Are we basing out or are we topping out? Are there more buyers or are there more sellers? Again, this is price. You can hear it in my voice. I get very agitated when I love it. I love that question because I get right back to basics. The basics is price. Yes, I like some of those indicators. I like the RSI weekly, not daily, because you get a lot of whipsaws. But weekly, it's pretty nice. It's a momentum thing. It's like that breath of the market. It's kind of an early signal that maybe you're going to have a change in the major trend, which is important. But I don't own that indicator. I own price. Up is good, down is bad, unless you're short.
And if you were to look for a bottom in the market, what would be something that you would look? Would you look at the advanced decline line stabilizing? What would it be if you were trying to find a bottom here, looking at just price?
Advanced decline line actually leads at the top because it starts to roll over early, but it lags at the bottom. Usually, you know, the troops, as you call them, are the last to get the message that the war is over. So, yes, I do still look at it, but I don't look at it as a bottom indicator per se. I guess I agree with a lot of people when they look at the VIX. You know, it's the CBOE volatility index. That's good because it's a measurement of sentiment. And it's high now, relatively speaking, around 32, 33, 34. But at major bear markets, I mean, the significance, we've seen the VIX a lot higher. We've seen it in the, unfortunately, we've seen it as high as in the 80s. I hope we don't have to go that high to get it. So I look at it. I again, it's only one thing. I look at the other sentiment indicators, AAII indicators. And, you know, a lot of people, I was with a bunch of technicians a couple of weeks ago. And, you know, after the meeting, I shook my head and said, wow, we're all basically saying the same things. You know, maybe I should be a contrarian, you know, go against the herd. And then the little voice in the back of my mind said, no, I don't think so. Maybe the majority can be right for a while. It's a tricky thing, but I look for percentage of stocks below the 200-day moving average. Again, very technical. If I get, you know, like 80-90% of them down there, you're close to bottoms. But it's a confluence of factors that I look at.
So you think, as you mentioned here, that we've probably got maybe another 10 to 15%. The NASDAQ is down about 27%. So another 10%, you know, we could be down 35, between 35, 40. What about the Dow?
Maybe not as bad, but 30%.
And the S&P?
Maybe a little bit worse than that, 30, 35%. I just got to stress, remember I said before, I'm a price guy. And patterns, you know, tops and bottoms, very important to me. And forgive me for saying this again, but the tops I see in the current market bring me back to the 70s, 1970s, early 1970s, which was a horrific bear market. And the year 2000 was a whole year. I'll never forget that 2000, the Dow kept churning and churning and churning and churning, and then finally broke down. So, those are the classic periods that suggest, again, technically, that there's more downside.
Yeah, it's absolutely amazing. You mentioned the 70s, and you take a look at, we've got the highest inflation rates. We just got the producer price index. It's up 11%. Fifth month in a row that it's been double digits. We've got oil prices over 100 coming from 50 a little over a year ago. It almost reminds me a little bit of the 70s.
That's when we had stagflation. Yeah, the stagflation period. I'm not, you know, history doesn't repeat, but it rhymes. And it looks like we're rhyming. And I'm not an economist, but the numbers are saying, hey, we haven't seen these since 40 years ago. Hello.
A final question. Given where the markets are and what you expect going forward, that this thing hasn't played itself out yet, if you own high-quality dividend-paying stocks, what would you do? Number two, if you weren't in that, is there anything that you would be putting your money in? Would you just be on the sidelines in cash right now, or are there things that you would buy that look attractive?
Let me answer the last one first. I think if I wasn't in the market, I'd be out of the market. I wouldn't be jumping at the, I'd be biting at the bit, you know, saying, gee, I'd like to start buying something here, but not yet, not yet. I would love to be able to buy Apple, but I think I'm going to get it a little cheaper before I buy the Apple back. And, you know, it depends if you got tax considerations, like you said, in California, where you get double tax, man, that's a killer. I think if you're in quality names, just tough it out. I mean, it's not the end of the world. We've been through these before, and it's painful for a while, but you got faith in God and the country, and yeah, we'll make it through this. We'll make it through this.
All right. Well, listen, Ralph, as always, it's a pleasure speaking with you. Glad to have you on the program. Stay well, my friend, and say hello to your wife.
Okay, sir. Thanks a lot. Take care.
The way your American audience should understand is this. Biden's sanction against Russia is absolutely deadly for the U.S. economy because it is going to be adding to inflationary pressure at a time that inflation is already very high. The war is only putting more pressure on the Fed, on Powell, to be more aggressive in terms of hiking rates. This is not going to do anything good for the U.S.
To listen to this full interview, in addition to gaining access to all of our premium content airing during the week, go to financialsense.com and hit the subscribe button.
If you're seeking financial advice and how to invest in today's markets, Financial Sense Wealth Management can help. From setting up or providing advice on 401k plans, managing corporate cash balances in a zero interest rate environment, to helping individuals, foundations, and businesses achieve their financial goals. Give Financial Sense Wealth Management a call today at 888-486-3939. Let us work together to help you get on the path to success. Financial Sense Wealth Management has been named as one of the top investment advisory firms in the U.S. by the Financial Times. Let us put our financial expertise to work for you. Call now at 888-486-3939 or email grow at financialsense.com. Advisory services offered through Financial Sense Advisors, Inc., a registered investment advisor. Securities offered through Financial Sense Securities, Inc., member FINRA SIPC. Both companies doing business as Financial Sense Wealth Management.
Price of oil has been hovering over $100 a barrel. Occasional spikes when the war in the Ukraine began. Where are prices heading, and why have they not come down? Joining the program is Gail Tverberg. She is editor of Our Finite World. And Gail, if you take a look at the arguments being made about energy prices today, the Republicans are blaming the price of oil on Biden's policies. Biden's blaming it on the war in the Ukraine. But as you have written, prior to the war in the Ukraine, the price of oil was, what, $99 a barrel? And I want to get into why that price is at $99 and not $50.
Well, I think basically, you know, the economy is being held up by a big debt bubble, and that debt bubble hasn't completely broken yet. And as long as the debt bubble doesn't break, the price stays up. Our problem is really a worldwide shortage of oil, coal, and natural gas. And we were experiencing that already. Having a growing supply of oil, coal, and natural gas allowed a huge debt bubble to grow. That debt bubble, the low interest rates kept getting lower and lower. We kept making it easier and easier to make loans and more leverage. And the bubble got bigger and bigger, and it just can't grow anymore. It's the Minsky moment. And we haven't gotten there yet completely. So that's why the price is still where it is.
And something that was occurring prior to this, and this occurred after 2014 when the price of oil fell precipitously with the Saudi oil war, is that companies have not invested adequately. That would be number one. And number two, I think the world, Gail, does not understand the meaning of depletion, because a lot of our oil comes from big oil fields like Garwar and others that were discovered, 50, 60, 70 years ago. So let's talk about depletion and how that is accelerating.
I think depletion is a bigger and bigger issue, even with, say, the shale fields in Texas. What happens is we exploit the biggest, easiest to extract ones that are, the most productive areas first. And then what's left is the likely to be less productive areas. So what happens is that we don't really see the investment needed now is not the same investment that was needed to produce a barrel of oil 5 years ago or 10 years ago. So when the oil companies get the money back, they say, well, that's nice, but we really need to be guaranteed prices of $150 a barrel going forward. And we have no guarantee of that. So we're just not going to invest. We'll give the money back to the shareholders and we'll invest in whatever the government is subsidizing this week.
As you pointed out in a recent article, the peak in production was hit in 2018. So even in 2019 and subsequent years, production is, we need about 5.9 million barrels that were down. And in your recent article, you talk about who can make up that difference. And I think you came up with roughly about 2.5 million barrels. You talk about Venezuela, Iran, but that's not going to do it. The world is under the illusion that the Saudis can ramp up to 12.5 million barrels, that they have this extra 2.5 million barrel spare capacity. I don't buy that. I don't buy that they can get up to that level, even at 10 million barrels. They have struggled to do that, and a lot of times it's come from inventory. So let's talk about Saudi Arabia and the role of OPEC.
What happens any place is that there are a lot of things that you can't really forecast as well as people would like to think you can. If you have oil in the ground, you don't know if you can really get it out. In fact, you don't really know. It's not an audited oil reserve. So you don't really know what's down there, what can be gotten out at what price. So that's a huge issue to begin with. So and you also don't know what the spare capacity is, except when you look at the production in the Middle East, it doesn't go up. It just stays flat. Even if there happens to be a little bit of spare capacity, which, like you say, I doubt, you have Nigeria and you have other countries whose oil production is depleting. Iraq in particular needs a lot more investment if it's going to be able to ramp its production up. Otherwise, it tends to head the other direction. So, these things are claims, the whole idea of the reserves and the spare capacity is it's just sort of some kind of a claim by these oil producers that makes them look good, but they're not really any kind of numbers that anybody can depend on. It really depends on what price the world can provide and how well the world economy can stick together.
You know, it's been said that the Saudis need probably close to $120 oil. A lot of the Middle Eastern countries need prices over $100 just to, you know, run the government to pay their expenses. And as the cost of finding oil and producing it gets more expensive, even Western oil companies need a higher price. But can the economy function at $150 oil? We saw what happened in 2008 when the price got up to $150 a barrel. We ended up going into a global recession.
Exactly. I think we could expect that again. What happens is that oil, the price of oil is a big determinant in the price of food. And it's also a big determinant in the price of transportation and whether you really can transport food around the world. And so when you have these high prices, it really creates a huge bottleneck. It becomes very difficult for poor countries to get enough food supplies. In fact, the whole world may be suffering from a lot of empty shelves.
So, you know, I was watching a program where there was a farmer. He farms about 16,000 acres, and he's talking about all his input costs have almost doubled. Most people don't realize a lot of the fertilizer used in farming comes from nat gas, and nat gas prices have almost doubled.
Yes, in the U.S., I know natural gas prices are way up, in large part because we are shipping so much natural gas off to Europe at the same time that our production is very much lagging.
So let's you know, one of the things that really struck me is we're going to this green economy. Here in California, you've got politicians like our governor that have got all these mandates. You won't be able to buy a gas car after 2030. You won't be able to bring a diesel truck in. Gail, recently I took a road trip driving from San Diego all the way up to Seattle on the I-5. What really struck me and the insight I got is the nation's highway system is like the artery system for our economy, and the trucks are the blood that fuel that economy. That's how you get goods to stores. That's how you get food to grocery stores. And part of the way, I think it was towards the end of the California, they had this big earth-moving equipment machines, big Caterpillar trucks and loaders. Gail, I just don't see how you're going to get equipment that big and that large running on batteries.
Exactly. And I'm sure that it will take away a great deal of the capacity of these trucks to carry very much goods. If you have to fill them up with batteries and they have to carry that heavy weight around with you, that's even assuming we can even find the materials to make all of these batteries. Someone else has pointed out that if you try to do that with tractors that work on farms, they sink in the dirt too much and you can't even use them for the purpose for which they're intended.
So when we take a look at the critical role that fossil fuels play in our economy, we're trying to go to a green economy. And I wonder if you might address renewables, because wind and solar don't work on many land places around the world. In fact, I've heard a figure that it's almost two-thirds of the landmass around the globe. Renewables don't work. So let's talk about, realistically, can you replace fossil fuels with windmills and solar panels? I don't think that can be done, or even with hydroelectric.
No, you can't replace the oil with wind turbines or solar panels or even hydroelectric. You know, there's several reasons. One of them is that the oil provides a whole range of different kinds of products. And it's this whole range of different kinds of products that the economy is adapted to. You know, some of them are things like lubricants and asphalt, but some of them, and plastics, of course, but some of the things are the diesel fuel and many other kinds of fuels. And we have so much built infrastructure and built automobiles and trucks and all of these things you cannot change over in any reasonable time frame to use the wind and solar and hydroelectric. It's also terribly, terribly intermittent. And the big intermittency is what I think of as the summer to winter intermittency. You know, you get your sun in the summertime and all you need to do is save it till winter. But you cannot do that with batteries. That's just absurd.
And so if we're moving in this direction and we've seen oil companies are not willing to invest unless they know they have a good price, because it takes a long time to bring an oil field into production. You have other industries that are not wanting to invest. And so we're trying to push this green agenda. But what happens in 10 years if, number one, we're going to need more electricity to power the green economy? I mean, Gail, just look at all the devices we have. We have smartwatches, smartphones, iPads, laptops, all the electronic devices. And what happens to the grid when at night, if you have a gas car, you pull it in the garage when you come home from work, that's it. But if you have an electric car, it's in the garage now, and all of a sudden everybody is charging their cars at night, pulling on the grid. I don't think we have the capacity to do that.
Well, you're not going to have any solar energy at night, for one thing. So, you know, this, you're depending on the wind to be blowing or maybe some hydropower. We don't have battery capacity that can keep that up. It becomes problematic already to provide enough electricity for many places in the country. I know California has been again mentioned as not perhaps being able to keep up with electricity supply for this year, and also the it's the central part of the country going up into Canada and down into Mexico, that there's too much dependence on wind power. And even already we're having difficulty dealing with all the intermittency.
And when we talk about going green, green takes minerals. People, you know, it's wonderful to say, hey, we're going to go to this green economy. But green takes copper, green takes nickel, green takes lithium, and we're not mining enough. In fact, there's shortages of copper. So, you know, I don't think these people have thought it all the way through. If we're going to go green, we're going to have to start doing a lot more mining, and mining uses fossil fuels.
Exactly. And of course, the mining that's being done right now is being done in poor countries around the world. And these poor countries are the big ones that are having the problems with higher food prices if oil prices are high. So you have real problems with uprisings there. You have problems with the high cost of transporting these minerals to the United States, if you can even get them out and keep the whole system going. So it's just a very unrealistic idea that these modelers have put forth.
So let's talk about the implications if the price of oil continues to go up because we just don't have production capacity or the ability to produce more. Because, you know, if you take a look at the 20th century and the 21st century up until about 2008, as population grew in the planet, a little over 1%, so did oil production. What happens, Gail, if population continues to grow at over 1% a year, but we're not able to grow production at over 1% a year?
Well, the way I see it is that it's a physics problem, and you end up with some breaks in the overall system. And I think that what happens is supply lines start breaking, like what we've been seeing already, and the international trade system starts falling apart. You start seeing more changes, like, well, we had the UK split off from the European Union, but we're going to see more changes where it becomes too expensive to have all these fancy layers of governments, and some of these governments are going to collapse or go away. It's going to affect the overall structure of the system in a way that people are not prepared for.
So let's talk about the implications. The thing that hit me with these kind of prices, and it's no mistake that Amazon reported its first loss in over 7 years. So, you know, during the pandemic, we got used to ordering online. Online shopping grew by 20, 30, 40% a year as they shut down the economy. But I don't know if Amazon's primetime business model works at $150 oil.
Well, they certainly have a lot of oil expenditures, and I don't know how they've arranged it with the people who are delivering it, but they certainly have to pay them enough for that high-priced oil or they'll quit.
So what happens to the economy if $150 oil is the new norm versus $50 oil? Consumers would love to have us go back to $50 oil where everything was affordable. Producers want to see $120 oil.
Like I say, what I think happens is that you get a financial collapse. And that financial collapse brings down, creates a lot of new problems that we aren't ready for at this point. And I don't know exactly what happens. You know, you get lots of different narratives and face-saving stories. You know, instead of having COVID, maybe it's a different reason we have for staying at home all the time so as to reduce oil use. But the situation changes badly, I'm afraid.
Yeah, and I would think that a lot of parts of the economy or businesses simply would not survive in a world of $150 oil. So we may get down to essentials. You know, maybe COVID was a precursor of life to come because with COVID, a lot of us got used to working from home. I just saw today high-powered Apple executive resigned because Apple wants its employees to return back to the office. I've had clients tell me that, you know, it takes almost $100 a week now just to drive to work. So maybe we work remotely from our homes. And that's part of the new world that we're entering into in this decade.
Oh, certainly. I think people will continue to work from home to a very significant extent.
So where do you see this going? As oil becomes scarcer, as the price goes up, are we more likely to see more conflicts? And I keep thinking of the Middle East, where a good bulk of the world's oil resides, or in Russia.
Yes, definitely. And I think, you know, people say that all wars are resource wars. That may be a slight exaggeration, but I think that to some extent, this situation that we're seeing in with Russia is being exacerbated by the oil problem and by the natural gas and coal problem. Russia really needs continued high prices in order to develop its the resources that it has. And so, and I think NATO is getting involved in this too, you know, because it's a fight, you know, is it the US or is it Europe or who gets cut short if there's not enough to go around? Very often what you find after these resource wars is that somebody gets left out. I know there was the collapse of the Soviet Union back in 1991, or the central government of the Soviet Union. You know, all of the individual republics continued there, but it was still the, but without the central government, it lost a layer of complexity. So things change.
The late Matt Simmons wrote a book called Twilight in the Desert, and he talked about Middle Eastern reserves, especially Saudi Arabia, that magically grew its reserves overnight to $260 billion, where they were in the late 1980s. They've been producing oil every single day, and yet their reserves shown have not changed in the last three or four decades. And that's where there's I wonder if you might address the production to reserve ratio, because a lot of the skeptics will say, well, look, Saudi Arabia's got 260 billion barrels of reserves. They could keep producing oil forever. That's not necessarily the case, because I don't think those reserves exist to the extent they say they are there.
It all depends on, you know, that Saudi Arabia has to be able to keep control of its population. It has to be able to keep up all of the infrastructure it takes for extracting the oil. We don't know that they can continue producing beyond this year, for example. You know, the amounts they put out are just purely fictitious. They're not audited. It's like asking some king off in an area, you know, what's your worth, you know? And they say, oh, it's very, very high. Well, yes, you know, you ought to worship me because everything is so wonderful here. These people have sort of exaggerated what's available to them.
How long do you think it will be when the world wakes up, Wall Street wakes up to the fact that we've almost reached peak production? In other words, we're not going to be able to grow production, so the price of oil is going to stay higher for longer. We may be able to keep it from rising precipitously if we go into a recession, because that reduces demand. Right now, the oil markets are reacting to the lockdowns in China. But, you know, the world is based, politicians are based on growth, and growth requires increasing amounts of energy. I don't care if it's for tractors to grow food, if it's for trucks to transport goods, if it's for factories to make those goods. What happens when it gets so expensive that we can't do that?
I'm not sure that we will understand how it all works. We live by narratives, and we live in a very networked system. And I think what fails is the financial system. And so everybody is so busy looking at the financial system, and they've never paid any attention to the energy system. So they say, oh, look at the debt bubble collapse. Oh, my goodness gracious. Our stock prices went to zero. Oh, goodness gracious. You know, they will not really understand what the situation is. And they'll say, oh, oil really isn't priced in dollars anymore. Russia is selling it for rubles, and they're selling it at a different price. You know, so the situation, I think, is going to change more than just your, you know, the people recognizing that there's a shortage. It's something that's been covered up for years and years and years, and I don't know that it will ever be completely uncovered.
You know, they say that conventional oil production peaked around 2004, 2005. You know, the fact that we're relying on shale, and most people don't realize that shale production, those wells tap out in about 2 years, which means you constantly have to be drilling new wells because the other ones run out after a couple of years. Fast payback, which the oil companies like, but the fact that we're doing shale tells me that we're scraping the bottom of the barrel.
Yes, we're scraping the bottom of the barrel. And what's happened, like I was mentioning before, is we looked at the best, we started using the best shale resources first. So now what we have is the least good shale resources. So we have to drill higher and higher priced resources, ones that are less productive, and ones that produce relatively more natural gas and relatively less diesel. And what the world needs is a lot of diesel for operating our trucks. So even when we do get it out, it's not as good quality oil as what we have been getting before we started getting into these shale resources.
You know, another factor too, it's not just politicians who are restricting drilling. That really hit me as I drove through California and Kern County, where there's oil. We know there's oil off the shores of Santa Barbara. But also you have Wall Street with wokeness. You had a hedge fund get a couple seats on Exxon's board. They want Exxon to divest itself of oil. Likewise for Shell Oil and BP. That's only going to exacerbate the problem if you want the people that produce the oil to restrict and get rid of oil.
You wonder what these people are thinking of, you know, and where they've been educated and what's going on. The upcoming elections, you think, come on now, are people going to reelect people who think this way? This is just such a strange way of dealing with situations. But as long as, the current administration promises the sky is the limit to everybody, that people don't stop to understand that a lot of the stories we've been told are just fictitious.
That's the problem. You have a narrative that is put out by the media, which lacks, in my opinion, a lot of critical thinking. It still surprises me. There are a lot of smart people on Wall Street that follow the energy industry, and it surprises me that none of them have ever questioned the reserve ratios that a lot of these Middle Eastern countries put out, especially Saudi Arabia. And they still look to Saudi Arabia as the kingpin of oil when they're really not.
Well, if you look at it, you'll find that Venezuela is reporting even higher reserves. And we can look at Venezuela and see what the production is doing, and we can see how their population is doing. And we should say, come on now, these reserves don't really mean anything. But people don't think that way. They just assume that the representations that are made are correct.
And that's the problem. I think that if we don't really start taking this seriously with policy and response, we could end up, I hate to see what's going to happen to economies or even the financial system if we go to $150 oil and some are predicting $250 oil. The economy simply does not work.
I'm afraid that we end up with a financial collapse before that happens. I guess I'm not one who says that the prices go up forever. I see that you have the system coming apart before that happens.
Well, I tell you, I think the world's in for a big energy shock. They don't like $100 oil. I don't know what they're going to say when it gets to $150. Listen, Gail, as we close, why don't you tell our listeners, you follow the energy markets and how it works with the economy and your website, Our Finite World. Tell people about it and what they're going to find there.
Well, I've been writing at Our Finite World back as far back as 2007. I have a lot of different articles. I've been writing about every 3 weeks now. But you can find it at the website. It's OurFinite, FINITE, world, WORLD.com. I have somewhat over 20,000 subscribers, but we also have people discuss various things during the 3 weeks between my writing articles. And so we have kind of a group there that are worried about this situation and putting forth articles they see explaining some of the things going on.
Well, I've seen your articles published at oilprice.com, and you do rather extensive research. Gail, I want to thank you for coming on our program. I just hope that perhaps we can wake up and maybe start solving this problem instead of what we're doing now. Thank you so much for joining us.
That concludes our weekend edition of the Financial Sense NewsHour. To speak with our financial planning and wealth management team, give us a call at 888-486-3939 or go to financialsense.com and click where it says Contact Us. If you aren't already a subscriber to our weekday podcast and would like to listen to more of our content where we regularly interview book authors, industry experts, and strategists from around the globe, go to Financial Sense and hit the subscribe button. On behalf of Financial Sense NewsHour and the Financial Sense Wealth Management team, we hope you have a pleasant weekend.
The Financial Sense NewsHour is for informational and educational purposes only and should not be considered as a solicitation or offer to purchase or sell any securities. The investments, investment strategies, and investment philosophies discussed or presented on the NewsHour each involve their own unique risk factors, which are not discussed on the show. Responses to listener inquiries are based on the personal opinions of the Financial Sense staff and do not take into account listener suitability, objectives, or risk tolerance. Financial Sense NewsHour and its parent company shall not be liable for any financial losses that result from investing in any companies mentioned in Financial Sense or arising out of the use of any material on the NewsHour. Be advised that you invest at your own risk.